Welcome to Intersection Live, the tax and accounting profession's premier podcast source, provided by the CPA Technology Advisor, supporting the accountant community. This is Tech to Go, a monthly fast-paced roundtable discussion with executive editor Darren Root and regular columnists of the CPA Technology Advisor. These thought leaders tackle current technology issues impacting the tax and accounting profession.
This is Darren Root, executive editor of the CPA Technology Advisor, and you are listening to episode 44 of Tech to Go. I have our three co-hosts with us today. I have Randy Johnston, a principal with K2 Enterprises. So welcome today, Randy.
Good day and welcome to all.
And Renee Lassert. Renee's here from as the CEO of Bill.com.
Great to be back. It's been a little while since we've talked.
It has been a while. And Dave McClure, the president of the U.S. Internet Industry Association. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you. On a rainy day here in Western Virginia.
You got our Indiana weather from yesterday.
Yeah, probably so.
Cold and rainy, which is we haven't been able to say that here in the Midwest for quite some time, have we, Randy?
Not for a while.
Yeah, so guys, we got a couple of great topics today. Dave sent me an email this morning and talking about internet security, and he really spent quite a bit of time in crafting this email, and it really is pretty startling. So Dave, let's talk a little bit about internet security this morning and kind of frame what it was that you were informing me about today.
Sure. It was interesting. I had an opportunity to sit down with Don Codling, who's a unit chief with the FBI Cybercrime Division, and talk to him about what the status is of cybersecurity today. And it was a very sobering discussion because what used to be some script kiddies writing viruses for fun has now become a major function of organized crime. It's very slick. It's very well done. They have changed the rules entirely. And for those who used to wonder whether, you know, computer security was more of a nice-to-have than a must-have, the rules have really changed. And we need to start rethinking how we do cybersecurity for your accounting office and for your home.
So, I'm just going to tell you something that happened to one of my clients recently, so you can kind of frame your discussion around that, because if our listeners don't understand how real this one actually really struck home to me. I do work for a small physician office here in Bloomington, and his wife kind of does the books internally, and oftentimes the office manager will work from home, and so she left PC Anywhere up and going because that's how she logs back in. So long story short, she was the spouse was looked at the computer one day, and there was the mouse was kind of moving around. She just assumed that the office manager was working a bit from home. What happened about 2 weeks later, as she was checking her bank account, she noticed that there was a couple of $15,000 ACH transactions that were taken out of QuickBooks, ran through payroll to an employee that was not of an employee of that particular company. So it was a new employee that had gotten set up in QuickBooks, and they were using QuickBooks for ACH. And so long story short, they backtrack this, and it comes from Russia. So there's a Russian organized crime group that's out browsing, you know, finds this particular computer, a small little company in Bloomington, Indiana, with PC Anywhere running, and essentially steals $30,000 from them very simply without ever even entering their office. So this is kind of a real situation. So I just wanted to kind of let our listeners hear how real at least that is from my perspective. So go ahead, Dave. Sorry about that.
Well, no problem, because you make one of the most important points, Aaron, and that is small businesses, especially businesses like accounting businesses, are being specifically targeted for the first time. We're all used to the stories about the big companies getting hit or the banks getting hit. Now they're going after small companies because they know you don't have a full-time security department working on this, and so you're going to be more vulnerable. And by the way, they're going after small governments, too. Your town government, your county government, they're very often running wide open computer systems, and that's what they're using to hack into the Pentagon or hack into the DOJ now. If they can get into your town police department and successfully hack that, they've got a doorway into the Department of Justice. Mm. So it has become very scary, and it is very organized. But there are some things that we can talk about that are ways that you can help to protect yourself. And number one right now is, you know, in the old days, Internet service providers used to say, wow, we're not doing anything here because we don't want to be accused of interrupting your signal, or maybe we'll block something we think is criminal, and it turns out, you know, it's the most important email you'll get all year, and you'll sue it. Nowadays, we've moved beyond that. And in fact, I encourage people to interview their Internet service provider, their web hosting service provider, their backup people, and even the accounting software companies that provide portals. You need to know what their security systems are. You need to know that they're adequate. You can't just rely on them. And I frankly believe that we're going to see ISPs stepping up to the plate and doing a lot more security-wise. So number one is know who you do business with. Number two is a big reversal for me, because I have told clients for years, leave your computers running night and day. It's better for them. You don't use that much energy. Well, guess what? Turn them off. Turn them off when you leave at the end of the day. Turn them off when you're not using them. And by all means, make sure that whether it's PC Anywhere or it's remote assistance under the Microsoft Windows operating system, make sure you shut those things down, and make sure you shut down your VPNs and every other link you've got into those computers. But turn your computers off every night. The reason for this is that the Trojans that affect your computer with a botnet does things on your computer and takes over your computer to use it for criminal activities. They most often do that in the middle of the night when they know there's nobody looking at that screen. So if your computer at the office is shut off, they can't use it for criminal activities. I'm sorry if that's inconvenient to compute in from home, but it's worth it for security. So those are the two biggest ones. The others are really standard stuff, like make sure that you're using antivirus software and make sure it covers your email. And don't open emails from people you don't need, and quit forwarding those stupid jokes around. That you're simply leaving your friends and your business associates, I believe, more vulnerable because they see it's from you and they assume it's not a virus, and that's a bad assumption. So just very simple things you can be doing, and I'm sure Renee and Randy, you've got some other things to jump in with as well as best practices.
Yeah, in fact, I guess I will jump in at this point because many of you know that, listen, and I know the three of you know that we actually developed a spam control product for a good number of years, had it about a decade, and actually sold it about this time last year. The prior 2 years while we owned that product, we'd noticed this very proactive attack, which we did attribute to organized crime, that was coming from global reaches into accounts. And of course, the job of our product was to block out the bad guys. And it was clear in the last 2 to 3 years that these guys have gotten more resources, more professional, more proactive at doing these attacks. Kind of position number one. Number two is we have been disturbed by some banks refusing to stand behind the transfers by bad guys from their accounts into other accounts because the transfer was executed legitimately. So there is a bit of a concern for clients and your own businesses alike. Are your bank accounts set up in such a way that if you have a theft that is unauthorized, that you'll be backed up, much like we see with the credit cards of today? So those two pieces are quite evident to us. Number three is I do believe that a number of the antivirus and anti-spy software have improved with Windows 7 and with some of the free products that are out there. So, Dave, I know that you'd thought directly about the free Microsoft or free AVG. That would be the minimum type of protection that we'd recommend at home computers and on business computers. Really a 1-2 punch of maintained firewalls and maintained antivirus is minimum to participate today.
And Randy, let me make the point, because I think that's a really critical point to make. I recommend using free Microsoft or free AVG on your home computer. That is not for your server under any circumstances, and it's not for your office network under any circumstances. They're not going to be strong enough. Let me just bring up one of the points that was made to us that I think is worth making, and that is you've got to be more aggressive about monitoring what your employees do online. One of the trends we're seeing very clearly is if they can get a botnet into your system and take control of your computer, it's not just that you're sending spam out from your company. They're also hiding illegal information. You become their storage servers, and if they want to put up credit card numbers and viruses to implant on other computers or child pornography, they're going to use your computer to store it on. Imagine the shock to open up a folder someday and find 10,000 credit card numbers or images of children. I mean, those kinds of things you don't want happening on your office computer, and you don't want a law enforcement officer knocking on your door and telling you you're the source of it. These are headaches you don't need. Look at the hard drives of your office computers and look on your servers. If there's a folder on there you don't recognize, find out what it is.
Hey, Renee, you've been CEO of an internet company for quite some time now. What are you guys seeing in this area?
Well, I was going to go back to kind of my suggestions and related to, I guess the first thing I was going to comment on was Randy's point about the bank standing behind. I mean, everybody should know that the regulation, something called Regulation E, that requires that if you as a consumer want to refute a transaction that's happened to your bank account, you can do that within 90 days for any reason. So you might have to go in and cite that regulation and push that on them. But as somebody who's initiating transactions, this happens to us, and we always have to reverse the transactions and then go after the fraudster who was trying to perpetrate that crime. So I consumers do need to know that they can refuse transactions that are on their bank statement. They should be reconciling their account at least monthly, if not daily. With today's online banking, it's pretty easy to do. I've set up, just personally, what I've done is I set up all sorts of alerts on my credit cards, my bank accounts. Any activity happens there, anything over $500, I get an email. So I think most of the online banking platforms allow that today, and I would strongly encourage people to do that, because ultimately when it gets to your pocketbook, it's really going to be painful. The other thing I would say is that another measure that we've advised our employees to do and just people in general is have kind of two sets of passwords. The stuff that's really important to you, the financial stuff, have that be really strong and really secure. But if you're just logging into your Facebook account or whatever, maybe that can be something simpler, that you have a hard time remembering all these passwords. But have a schema that you use for whenever you're going to each of the sites you go to. And that's, I'm sure Dave probably has lots of ideas on that, and so does Randy, that you have a certain schema so that you know, and you can have different passwords at every site you go to, but there's a methodology to it. And then I would say that what we're seeing in general is we divide out everything that's in our office between what's for our customers and what's for ourselves. We are more and more using services in the cloud, so our Gmail is up in the cloud for everybody, the calendar is in the cloud, our wikis in the cloud. So more and more, some of the security issues are incumbent upon the provider that we're using and what security they're providing. So we always look at that. We look for the SAS 70s. We look for any of the obvious things that you ought to have, such as encryption between. You look at their policies and procedures and make sure that it is going to be secure. So I think that there's the challenge here is that there's just so much to do. it's not a simple thing. You have to be thoughtful about it. You can't just assume it's going to go away.
So Randy, if our listener is your traditional small accounting firm, what are they even to do at this point?
Well, like Renee just pointed out, there's much to be done, but I think to be simple about it, the minimum is to put in a firewall that is strong, that has monitoring on the firewall itself. That's kind of your first line of defense. For most small firms, products from SonicWall and WatchGuard are two that would be potential starting points. These firewalls have updates that occur frequently, sometimes daily. Software can be on there that is proactive for antivirus, and that's a good additional add. The second step is to actually have a strong antivirus, business-grade antivirus, that covers the entire network, servers and workstations alike. The products that do that, there's probably 8 or 10 that are good and have different strengths and different qualities over time. So right now I'm using a lot of Viper just because I like that it's low overhead but very, very thorough in terms of what it does. So a product that's maybe in a suite, the McAfee suite might be an example here, could be reasonably good coverage. But the key is firewalls that are monitored and updated and antivirus that's installed and updated.
So, Iwi, is there a big argument to be made for, you know, moving to more of the SaaS-based virtual office type applications, you know, that whether CCH or Thomson or any of the other vendors have out there? Does that really help? What would be your take on that?
Well, both Thomson and CCH use even stronger industrial-grade scanning mechanisms, as do most hosted data centers. Number two is the people that are responsible for the networks in those operations have very proactive security monitoring and pretty much 24/7 days a week type of monitoring as well. So there's somebody of very high talent trying to do the security. I think that those environments, however, are high profiles for attack. So just like Dave correctly pointed out, over the last 3 to 5 years, CPA firms, law firms, and banks have become high-profile attack targets. I think these consolidated hosters will also become pretty high-profile attack targets where bad guys will be trying to break in. It's going to be a situation where we're going to have some major breaches, I believe, but I also believe today that these large-scale hosters have more resources and can do more to protect the data than we can with our small operations today.
And I think that's becoming obvious within the industry. I think we're beginning to see, I'm certainly seeing more dialogues among internet service providers and web hosting services about what more they can be doing in the realm of security. But Randy, one of the things that both you and Renee mentioned that I think is really critical here is go online, do online banking, because at least with my bank, there's no way I can take money out of my account doing online banking. The most I can do is transfer it to another account that I own. But I go on every single morning and check my account to see what's there, to see what's pending. I'm often able to track little areas where, for example, I went online last week, I bought a new camera. The company double billed me for it. In the middle of setting up the billing transaction against my debit card, it popped up and said, oh, this is timed out. So I went on and I called them and said, look, what happened? Did it go through? And they said, oh, no, it didn't go through at all. Let us get your card number. We'll process it for you. Well, it pops up and they've double billed me. I wouldn't even have known that for 30 days unless I checked every day. And if someone hits your corporate bank account for $15,000, as was the case that Darren was mentioning, you certainly can do more about it the morning after than you can 30 to 45 days later when you reconcile your bank account. So the point I would make is get yourself set up for online banking and check your account every single day for anomalies.
And I think, Dave, just kind of, somebody who builds services for people that are small businesses that are out there and accountants out there. What we did at PayCycle, for example, is as soon as a new employee that had been a PayCycle customer, an email would have gone to the administrator saying you've added a new employee, and a phone call would have happened probably the next day saying, are you sure you want to add this employee? So, even though the transaction would have been set to go, it would not have gone. At Bill.com, we again have the email notifications that you can have emails sent to you every day, the second something happens or whatever. And we encourage all the customers to do that. And it becomes way more secure than what they had before, which was check stock lying around the office. So, I think, there's plenty of tools today. And I guess that's the upbeat side of the story here. Plenty of tools today enable you to actually have more control and more safety over your accounts if you just take the time to, you know, set it up.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, in the time we have left, let's talk just a little bit about the new USB 3.0. Randy, what do you know is going on there?
Well, the 3.0 technology has begun shipping from a number of different vendors. Probably the hold up or slowdown is the integration of USB 3.0 into the system board designs from Intel. However, a few things that our listeners need to know with this new technology. Number one is you can purchase the technology with backwards compatibility, but not all 3.0 has USB 2.0 backwards compatibility. So number one, if you're making a USB 3.0 acquisition, make sure you look for backwards compatibility in the short term. That'll continue to support your USB sticks, your USB hard drives, your cellular modems, and all those different types of items. Number two, the technology is radically quicker. A typical 600 meg file will come down on a USB 3.0 drive or stick in 10 to 12 seconds. That same transfer on a USB 2.0 would look to be 6 to 7 minutes conservatively. So this can make a huge difference in transferring files and the way the devices work. For example, you can use USB-attached monitors, I think, safely in USB 3.0. The new generation devices for USB 3.0 are falling in cost pretty notably. So 16 to 32 gig flash memory and 3.0 is not a lot different than a 2.0 device. So I think that we'll find that replacement will happen pretty quickly based on the availability of both hard drives and USB sticks. I know Dr. Bob and I were in a toy store. That would be Fry's Electronics and Best Buy to you guys in late August, and we were actually amazed at the number of 3.0 hard drives and 3.0 USB sticks that were available for purchase. Finally, one caveat on the cabling: USB 3.0 devices take a different cable. So there'll be a period of time where we go through what I call the fear, uncertainty, doubt factor of USB 3.0 cables being sold for a large premium. They are different, but there's nothing extraordinary in their structure other than a bit of shielding. So don't be fooled by buying ultra-expensive 3.0 cables. Wait for the price to fall a little bit, but do understand you're going to have new generation cabling as well. So kind of in recap, new higher speeds, really a quite different technology that you need to look for backwards compatibility, and then watch for the cables that need to be different as well.
Now, Randy, can I be the curmudgeon here? I mean, we are now into, you know, USB version 3.
Yes.
So why are we still fooling around with it being a hardware-only solution? Why aren't we putting this on some sort of flash-upgradable ROM so that we don't have to go through this? I mean, I'm sitting here trying to jigger USB 2.0 capabilities into a motherboard that was set up for only USB 1.0, and along comes 3.0. Why are we still having to swap out a motherboard every time they upgrade the USB ports? And the other thing is, why are we still getting motherboards with only 2 or 4 USB ports when every device in the world has gone to USB? They ought to be putting them with 8 or 10 ports to a motherboard, and I don't see that happening. I don't know why.
I don't see it happening either. I do know that part of the issue on the multiple ports is the USB trees support naturally 4 devices. So when you have one single port, they can cascade and support 4. Do agree, Dave, I would like to have a lot more than I typically have. My current laptop only supports 4. And even at that, that's been a little tight at times. There are mechanical differences in the 3.0s and the 2.0s and the 1.1s and the 1.0s. So I suspect that some of the, you know, as we did it with modems where we could actually do everything in software, I think some of that may not have been well enough thought out in advance to make it where it could be software upgradable. Hopefully, though, we won't see any changes in USB for decades at this point.
No. Now, come on, Randy.
How quickly
did we go from 1 to 1.1 to 2 to 2.1 and now to 3? It hasn't been decades. And besides which, they could make
years,
it upgradable.
Right?
Thank you, Renee. They could make, that's one decade. Okay, I'll give him that. They could make it upgradable. It's an engineering question. It's not a technical issue. They are doing it to sell more hardware.
Yeah.
And I kind of resent that.
Yeah, understand where you're coming from on that. But see, I don't think USB 3.0 is a keeper for the long haul. I actually do think that the next change will be more towards ultra-wide bandwidth, FireWire, those type of technologies. And so, honestly, I don't see this being a change that's, the USB 3.0 mechanisms, I don't see it changing maybe until it's retired.
Well, Bluetooth is coming back then, right?
Yeah, Bluetooth could be coming back.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, we're out of time today. We've exhausted our time. Dave, great discussion on Internet security. It sure scares the time out of me, though, as a small business owner, as I suspect it does a lot of our listeners. It's kind of the world we live in now, right?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's scary out there, sadly.
Yeah. So, gentlemen, thanks so much for your time today, and look forward to our next discussion.
All right.
Sounds great.
Good day.
The CPA Technology Advisors Intersection Live podcast series is brought to you by ADP Small Business Services, supporting the accountant community. For more information about the CPA Technology Advisors' other podcast programs, webcasts, and our e-newsletter, visit cpatechnologyadvisor.com. To ask questions or leave comments about our podcasts, call 800-456-0864, extension 2106. Or tune in to future episodes where you're able to ask questions live via talkshoe.com.